Hi, my name is David Lopez, co-dean of Rutgers Law School in Newark, New Jersey, and this is The Power of Attorney. It is my profound pleasure to have with me one of our outstanding professors, Professor of Law and Judge John O. Newman Scholar, Otto Hawk. Professor Hawk, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I've been wanting to get you on this podcast for a long time. Now, Professor Hawk is an internationally recognized expert in the law and ethics of armed conflict, international criminal law, and criminal law theory. He recently published his first book in 2017, Law and Morality at War. So we're going to talk a lot about the work that you've done. But just to get started, just sort of tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up at our beloved Rutgers Law School.
Thanks, David. So I grew up mostly in New York City, but did a little bit of my schooling in India, which is where my father is from. I went to Georgetown, where I fell in love with philosophy, and then went to Yale for law school, clerked on the Second Circuit for John Newman, a wonderful judge. Worked briefly at Debevoise and Plimpton, a bit on civil rights and a bit on white-collar crime, and then came to Rutgers and have been here since 2008. So when I started my career, I focused on the philosophical foundations of international criminal law, then moved over to focus more on the law of armed conflict, which is about how militaries conduct themselves in war. And today I focus more on the law of interstate force, which is about when states can go to war in the first place, and also the sources of international law, so how to interpret treaties, how to identify customary international law, that sort of thing.
And when you went to law school, was it your intention to become a law professor, or did you sort of stumble into this?
So I really decided in undergraduate that I wanted to be an academic of some kind. And the only real question for me was whether I wanted to be a law professor or a philosophy professor. And it was really when I started law school that I decided that I wanted to focus on law, although from a philosophical perspective.
What do you think generated this interest in law and philosophy?
So I think it came from two places. So I think I had a subject matter interest in international law really from the time I was a teenager, because my mother worked at the United Nations. And so at night around the dinner table, we were talking about international issues, often with a kind of legal angle. And then when I started my undergraduate studies, I just really fell in love with philosophy and realized that that is just how my mind works. And so when I decided to be a legal academic, it was sort of natural that I would do so from a philosophical angle.
Now, you said you spent a couple of years at Debevoise and Plimpton. And Debevoise and Plimpton is certainly known around the law school because it has several alumni from Rutgers Law School. I'm not sure if that played a part in you ending up here, but tell us about your path from private practice to Rutgers Law School specifically.
Yeah, so I enjoyed my time at Debevoise quite a lot. I made lifelong friends. I learned a lot about the practice of law. But the whole time I knew I wanted to be a law professor. And so I would ride the subway with these thick tomes that I would read on the way to and from work. I wrote articles after hours. And, I don't think I talked too much with Rutgers alums when I was deciding to come here. But I do remember very distinctly that when I sent out my departure email thanking everyone at Debevoise for everything they had done for me, informing them that I was moving to Rutgers to be a professor, the very first email I got was from a Rutgers alum congratulating me and wishing me well and telling me what a great place Rutgers was.
And what has your experience been?
My experience has been fantastic. Teaching first-year criminal law is a joy every single year. When students arrive with so much energy and enthusiasm, and whatever their background and whatever their interests, everyone is interested in criminal law and criminal justice. Even if they have no intention of practicing in the area, it is just a field of immense human significance. Everybody cares about it. Everybody wants to understand it better. So there's always a lot of energy in the room. And my upper-level classes are great, but in different ways. So I teach an upper-level seminar on the law of war, and it's a great experience. Often my seminars are half veterans, so Rutgers students who have served overseas in the military, often in combat settings, and then half, you know, just general law students who are interested in the subject. And the conversation between those two groups is always really fascinating. And students learn a lot. I learn a lot from our veterans. And it's always a really rewarding teaching experience.
Yeah, and one thing that I'm sure both of us have heard from our colleagues on the faculty is that the conversations at Rutgers Law School tend to be very robust compared to some of the other law schools, and sort of go off in many, I think, really stimulating and interesting directions. And it sounds like, you know, that is sort of the dynamic that you're describing.
Absolutely. It's always a fascinating conversation between people who have these very impactful life experiences that they want to understand better and process in a different way.
And I think to many, you know, outside the field, I think the first question is going to be, why is there such a thing as the law of war? Because I think people think of wars being almost like inherently chaotic and not necessarily something that is regulated. Can you talk a little bit about how law and morality found its way into issues of armed conflict?
Absolutely. So war has actually always been regulated by some set of norms for centuries. Whether those norms were legal, moral, or religious was a bit hard to say because those distinctions didn't really exist yet. But as law emerged as a kind of distinct set of norms and set of ideas, the legal regulation of war started to take center stage. So first, there were laws of war within different civilizations, within different societies regulating armed conflict. And then it was really in the 19th century that the international law of war, a shared set of standards across cultures, across countries, across religious traditions, began to emerge and really crystallized in the 20th century. And I would say really in the 1970s, when you really start to have a very sophisticated and detailed set of rules that states of all backgrounds accepted and agreed to.
Okay. Can you talk about some of the structures and mechanisms that developed this law of war?
Yeah, so in the 20th century, one of the driving forces has been the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is a non-governmental organization that was founded to really aid the victims of war, the sick, the wounded, civilians living under occupation, to administer humanitarian relief and so on. So really as a humanitarian organization. But from the beginning, they realized that they could not do their job unless war itself was constrained by a set of legal rules that all the participants accepted and would generally adhere to. And so in the 20th century, the ICRC really took the lead in drafting the Geneva Conventions in the 1940s, and then the additional protocols in the 1970s. And they would convene diplomatic conferences, bringing together states from around the world. The ICRC would present draft texts. The states would debate, discuss, modify them as they saw fit. And then a final treaty would emerge from that process.
And what are the enforcement mechanisms for these rules?
That's a great question. So the primary enforcement mechanism for the law of armed conflict is internal. It really comes from the militaries themselves, first instructing their soldiers on what the rules are, and then enforcing and punishing their violations. And that's an important thing to remember because, you know, we often think of international law in terms of international courts, but no international court can oversee all the armed conflicts going on around the world. So the burden really is on individual states and their militaries to maintain discipline within their armed forces, teach them what the law is, drill them on the law, and ensure that they're complying with it.
And what's the relationship between the political leadership in the country and the military installation of these legal norms?
So it varies a lot by country. So in some countries, there's more of a separation between civilian and military legal structures. And I would mostly characterize our system in that way. So the service branches have their own legal departments. The Department of Defense has its own view about the law of armed conflict. And then the State Department and the Justice Department have their own perspectives. But the primary instruction that soldiers receive is from the Department of Defense and the service branches.
So talk about your book, Law and Morality at War, Oxford University Press, 2017. Talk about the whole process of writing that book and what that book was about.
Yeah, so for many years, I was writing really for two different audiences. So I was writing law review articles for a legal academic audience and philosophy articles for a philosophy audience. And the book was really my attempt to try to bring those two strands of my scholarship together and to try to present a unified view of the role of moral reasoning and moral philosophy in law and interpreting, developing, and defending the law of armed conflict. And so the book covers many, many topics. It covers the use of civilians as human shields. It covers how certain a soldier needs to be that a given individual is a lawful combatant and not a civilian before using lethal force. It covers what precautions soldiers should take to avoid unintentionally harming civilians when they carry out military operations. It covers a lot of different discrete topics, but the overall connecting thread is the idea that the law of armed conflict should provide moral guidance to soldiers. So soldiers have to act ethically in incredibly difficult circumstances where they have limited information, they are under a threat, they may be afraid, they may be angry, they may be tired, they may be confused. And the law is there, I argue, to provide them the best moral guidance possible in those circumstances. And so in each of these different domains, we want to either create or interpret legal rules to provide soldiers with that best possible moral guidance.
What were some of the thorniest issues you found yourself dealing with when you wrote the book?
So I think the issue that I took most to heart was probably the issue of human shields, because in 2015, the U.S. Department of Defense issued its Law of War Manual, its first edition of its Law of War Manual, which took the view that if enemy forces use civilians as human shields, the attacking force does not have to consider harm to those civilians when it is designing its own military operations. So no matter how many civilians are in harm's way, and no matter how trivial or insignificant the target is from a military perspective, attacking forces can just go ahead as if those civilians weren't there. And so I wrote a series of essays on the Just Security blog, as well as in a law journal called International Law Studies, really strongly criticizing this view. And the book developed those arguments in various ways. And I was very happy to see that actually just before the book went to press, the Department of Defense changed that view about human shields and now takes a view much closer to the one that I had advocated. So that was a great relief. So that's probably the part of the book that I'm proudest of.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Can you talk about what your view was and your criticisms of the use of human shields?
So the use of human shields is categorically prohibited by international law. That wasn't the controversial part. The controversial part was, what if the other side uses civilians as human shields, essentially to dissuade, let's say, you, the attacking force, from carrying out some operation against some target that would otherwise be lawful to attack? So the Department of Defense initially took this view, again, that you essentially treat those civilians as if they weren't even there. So in legal terms, you do not consider whether the harm to those civilians would render your attack disproportionate in light of the military advantage that you're trying to achieve. So that's what I meant when I said that no matter how insignificant or trivial the target might be, on the Department of Defense's view, you can just go right ahead and carry out the attack. So my view was that this is completely wrong, and that if the opposing force is forcing civilians to serve as human shields, what we call involuntary human shields, then you treat those civilians the same way you would treat any other civilians. So it doesn't matter whether civilians are in harm's way because they're forced to be in harm's way or it's just bad luck. However they get there, you always have to ask, is it worth it? Is this target so valuable that striking it justifies the harm that you are going to inflict on these innocent people? And that is the view that the Defense Department did adopt, which I think was excellent, again, not just for our sake and for the sake of how our armed forces would act, but also because international law is the same for us as it is for anyone else. So if the United States takes the view that civilians used as human shields don't count, then that view can be adopted by any other state who may not share the moral scruples of our own armed forces. Just to expand on that for a second, when the Defense Department's Law of War Manual was first issued, a number of very conscientious, thoughtful, and ethical members of the armed forces said, well, look, yes, the manual does take these views that sound somewhat extreme, but we would never actually do that. We would always consider the potential harm to civilians in any of these cases. And I actually believe them. I take them at their word. But other countries, other armed forces may not share those moral principles. And so it was very important for the United States to walk back from that position and embrace the position that I described.
That's really interesting. How would you sort of assess the general commitment in the international community to these international norms? Do you find that there's a commitment to following these norms, or do you see it fraying? Do you see any trends that are going on that either concern you or that I think our listeners might find interesting?
So I think it varies a lot by country. I think that the United States, the United Kingdom, take the law very seriously, by which I mean they try very hard to follow the law as they understand it. And that is why it is so important for me as a scholar to make sure that they understand it correctly, because I do think it will make a difference to how they behave. There are other states, Syria, Russia, Iran, who I think do not take the law particularly seriously. At most, the law plays only the following role, which is that there are some states that violate the law, but not so egregiously that they cannot come up with some flimsy legal justification for what they are doing, something that is implausible on its face. And then there are some countries who I think flagrantly violate the law without much regard to whether they could publicly justify it. And so I do think that there are a range of different approaches to the law, and a range of different degrees of compliance, and the way different states use the law and regard the law varies, I think, a lot.
So these countries that basically flout the legal norms, what is the best way to secure compliance? Is there any way to secure compliance? Or is this just something that has to be done in through basically moral argumentation, political pressure?
I think that's right. I think that so international law in general cannot be coercively enforced. There is no world state that can punish Russia or Syria or Iran for its wrongdoing. So I do think that you either need to persuade various actors to follow the law for moral reasons, or you need to show them that it is in their self-interest to do so, or you need to inflict reputational damage on them so that they suffer some cost that they recognize as a cost in response to their wrongdoing. And I think what has happened is that there is an attitude of lawlessness by the major powers and a erosion of the idea that a country's reputation depends, at least in part, on its compliance with international law. And as that general attitude spreads, it infects every particular area of international law, including the law of armed conflict. So if the United States appears to be flagrantly violating international law, for example, with respect to the resort to military force, using military force in various countries without any or with a very flimsy legal justification, that reduces the reputational pressure on countries like Russia or Iran or Syria that they need to, again, at least conduct themselves in a way that they could defend legally, even if that legal defense is flawed or in bad faith.
So basically you're saying by, you know, serving as kind of the beacon of virtue and compliance, you in essence pressure or persuade other countries less inclined to compliance to follow the norms.
I think that's right.
So, you know, I think in sort of, you know, the broader public debate in this country over the last 10 or 15 years, there've been a lot of issues that, you know, that people have raised in the context of international law. So following 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, there were many concerns raised about, you know, waterboarding and involuntary rendition. I think during the Obama administration, there were a lot of concerns raised about the use of drones, the increased use of drones. And I think, you know, recently in the Trump administration, you know, there were concerns raised about the decision to use a drone strike on the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. And I know that all of these have sort of made their way into the sort of the domestic political context and, you know, have really, I think, generated a lot of back and forth and a lot of debate. This is your field, right? Mm-hmm. These are the issues that you're working on.
Absolutely.
So do you have, you know, really some thoughts? I know that you have some thoughts on, you know, the recent assassination of the Iranian general, but do you have, you know, thoughts on how I think the public debate on waterboarding and torture, the compliance with the Geneva Convention, and then, you know, the drone strikes under Obama, on how they have impacted, I think, the United States's reputation broadly?
So the U.S. strike on Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, the Iranian reprisal, missile strikes against U.S. bases in Iraq, and in the midst of all of this, the downing of a civilian plane, killing almost 200 innocent people, was a really horrible sequence of events, both for the human consequences for these civilian passengers, and also for, again, international law as a whole. First, we had a major use of military force on the territory of Iraq, essentially to eliminate a Iranian general who had some role in Iran's overall military strategy in the region, which obviously was adverse to U.S. interests. This is one incredibly destabilizing move. Iraq is a sovereign country. It is for it to decide who uses military force within its territory, when and for what purpose. Iraq is also our ally. And so the fact that we carried out an operation that the Iraqi government later condemned as an act of aggression against it is really a bizarre turn of events in international relations. Second, there is a categorical prohibition in international law against armed reprisals. So the Iranian response was, again, flagrantly illegal, followed several days of public statements promising some act of retaliation. And finally, the downing of the civilian plane was, at a minimum, a terrible failure to distinguish between military targets and civilian targets. So ostensibly, some Iranian unit could not tell whether this blip on their radar screen was a civilian plane or an American response to the Iranian reprisal, and decided to shoot down this plane without first verifying what it was. At a minimum, that's a violation of the law of armed conflict. But even more disturbing, it seems that the Iranian government allowed civilian planes to continue to take off and land from their airport, which was near Iranian military facilities, in part to dissuade the United States from striking those military targets, which I've argued is a form of human shielding, which, as we discussed earlier, is also categorically prohibited under international law. So in this short sequence of events, you had several egregious violations of international law, and we see the human consequences. And those, you know, so those civilians will never come back. Their families will never see them again. And so we see very vividly where lawlessness quickly leaves.
So what has been the international fallout from this assassination, or has there been any?
So there was immediate reaction from a variety of states, either condemning one action by the U.S. or Iran, or both, general condemnations of the use of force and imploring both sides to return to diplomacy. But probably the most explicit and dramatic statement was given recently by the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killing, who in her report to the UN Human Rights Committee condemned the U.S. strike as an act of aggression and therefore as a violation of international human rights law. And this was a very significant statement by any UN body with respect to this particular incident, but also a major statement about the content of international law and its requirements, and it in some ways moved certain debates that the field had been having forward in what I think is a productive direction.
That's pretty intense stuff. Talk about drones for a minute. I believe that the Bush administration, you know, really started using drones, but I think that the Obama administration was known for its use of drones, and it really, you know, generated a lot of controversy. How does the issue of using drones generally, how is that analyzed? How does the military approach that issue? What thoughts do you have on the use of drones by the United States abroad?
So as a strictly legal matter, there is no legal difference between using drones, fighter jets, naval bombardment. From a legal perspective, what matters is, are you using military force? If so, where and why? And so we can use the drone campaign as a kind of shorthand for the use of military force in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq. But from a legal perspective, what matters is the use of military force justified, not what particular weapons platform was used. Now, from a policy perspective, the concern with drones is that they lower the cost of military intervention because there is less risk to the soldiers of the intervening state. So there's a policy concern that the introduction of drones will proliferate the use of military force around the globe. And I think that concern is justified, and I share that concern. But again, as a strictly legal matter, what we want to know is, why is, say, the United States firing Hellfire missiles in the mountains of Pakistan or in Syria or in Iraq, a few miles from the airport?
Yeah. So I want to talk about the present moment on three different levels. I want to talk about your criminal law class. I want to talk about, you know, the pandemic and how it impacts your research. And I want to talk about what you're working on now. But before we do that, I want to make sure that we have an opportunity for you to plug. And you said that you didn't know if you wanted to be a law or philosophy professor, but we do have a Rutgers Institute for Law and Philosophy. So it sounds like you haven't really had to make the decision yet. Can you talk a little bit about what the Rutgers Institute for Law and Philosophy does?
Absolutely. So the Institute is an interdisciplinary institute that brings together professors from the Newark campus, the Camden campus, and the New Brunswick campus, where we have just incredible depth and expertise in legal philosophy. And so the Institute does a variety of things. Most importantly, at least before COVID, we had annual conferences and inaugural lectures, bringing outside scholars to Rutgers to discuss a variety of issues in legal theory. We often place the proceedings in Rutgers journals, and it's also just a forum for the Rutgers faculty, those of us who are philosophically inclined, to engage with one another, share papers, and discuss various issues. Oh, and I should also say the Institute also organizes curricula for students. So whether you want to do JD and a master's degree in philosophy, or you just want to know where to go within Rutgers for legal philosophy courses, the Institute is there to support students in that as well.
Talk about how you ended up teaching criminal law. How many years have you been teaching criminal law?
I think 12, 13.
Okay.
So actually, in some ways, I started as a criminal law theorist who focused on international criminal law.
Okay.
So my first few years, if you look at where I was publishing, it was often in criminal law journals, but trying to bring criminal law theory and the philosophy of criminal law to international criminal law, which at the time was very doctrinal, very black letter, very focused on procedural issues, which were very important at the time, but maybe losing sight of why are we engaged in international criminal law in the first place? What are we trying to achieve? What is its justification? What is its fundamental moral rationale? And so those were the issues that I was focused on at that time. So I've always taught first year criminal law. It is still my favorite class to teach. And the present moment makes it both more important and more challenging. You know, I firmly believe that we cannot have racial justice in this country without criminal justice reform. And I don't think we can have criminal justice reform only involving policing. We also have to reform substantive criminal law, what we criminalize and how we punish. And to do that, we need to understand substantive criminal law. And so I've always thought of my first year course as one piece of the puzzle, providing students with that understanding of how substantive criminal law works, so that whatever they end up doing with their lives, practicing in criminal law or only involved in it as a concerned citizen, they will have that background understanding. And I still believe that. I still believe that is the function of my class, to give that, to give them that deeper and general understanding of this particular piece of the puzzle. But there's no question that the moment we're living in makes it hard to bracket the rest of the puzzle, that bigger picture. And it's going to be a struggle, I think, throughout this semester. Finding that balance between giving them the legal understanding that they need and engaging with them as human beings living through a frightening, difficult time in our nation's history.
Yeah, and you know, I took criminal law last century, and I think criminal law has always been the, in many ways, the most difficult first year course to teach, because it really, I think, generates a lot of passion. And I know that there is a very robust discussion in academia about how to address issues of gender and race. Can you talk about really how you navigate this? I know that last Friday, you talked about a criminal justice case and its implications with respect to racial justice. Can you generally talk about how you kind of work in this terrain with students that obviously bring different backgrounds and different passions to these topics?
Yeah, so for me, issues of race and gender have always been part of my criminal law class. And I'll just mention, even more so, my criminal procedure class. So I often teach criminal adjudication, which is basically the second half of the criminal trial process. We call it bail to jail. So in that course, you simply cannot understand how the Supreme Court came to incorporate various criminal procedure protections against the states without understanding the racial context of the middle of the 20th century and the second half of the 20th century. Criminal law, I think, is somewhat similar, although maybe the gender dimensions are more at the foreground. So many of the core cases in a criminal law class involve issues of race. So the case I was discussing on Thursday is called People versus Due, which is a really tragic case of a 15-year-old African-American girl who was shot and killed in a grocery store. And this was in the early 1990s in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. And there is simply no way to discuss the case strictly through the lens of the law of voluntary manslaughter without thinking about how the store owner perceived this 15-year-old child and why she thought that pulling out a handgun and pointing it at her and, according to the jury at least, intentionally pulling the trigger, why that thought even crossed her mind. And there are other cases throughout the semester that bring race to the foreground. I think criminal law is different because I think issues of gender are much more at the foreground of the case. So I've always taught the law of rape and sexual assault. I know there are criminal law professors who don't, who avoid those topics. I've always taught it. I think it is one of the core areas of substantive criminal law. Every student needs to understand it, grapple with it, and discuss difficult issues about both what is wrongful sexual violation and what should be criminal, and whether there is a gap between those two things, between what is wrong and what should be criminal, or whether they should converge. So I consider that a core part of my class, and I always have.
I guess I'm just wondering, how do you kind of ensure that, you know, that robust debate and that the students learn as they must, that there's going to be a lot of disagreements on these issues, and they need to work through, you know, the differing perspectives. What is your sort of teaching philosophy? How do you navigate that terrain? How do you make sure that students, you know, feel heard regardless of what their views are?
So first, I've been fortunate to have very outspoken students who respectfully but candidly engage with one another on all manner of issues. And I encourage that. I think the one sort of teaching tip that I have used is to ensure that both sides of any issue are always represented, if by no one else, then by me. And I think that makes people more comfortable to take positions without feeling that their character or their basic values will be put into question. So for example, in the law of rape and sexual assault, one of the core questions is whether felony sexual assault should have a force requirement, so the defendant is only guilty if they use force, or whether felony sexual assault should only require non-consent on the part of the victim or survivor. It's a core question that we have to confront. I often start that conversation by asking people, what is the best argument for the force requirement? And usually students come up with arguments quite quickly. So they might think that it is important that the defendant, that it be unmistakably clear to the defendant that the victim is not consenting and that the force requirement plays some role in that process. Other students may argue that, in their view, our criminal justice system is already too expansive and too punitive. So even if all non-consensual sex is seriously morally wrongful, only forcible sexual assault should be criminalized and result in incarceration in order to kind of ratchet back the spread of mass incarceration. Those are just two examples of arguments that students make on a yearly basis, representing what might otherwise maybe be considered a more conservative position. So I think that asking students, soliciting from them the best argument for any side of a given issue opens up the classroom to robust and free-flowing discussion where people feel comfortable making an argument or floating a trial balloon and putting a question out for discussion.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you know, I've been very proud to see sort of the level of discussion by our students and the way that our faculty really manages that and encourages that. So I'm very proud of that. You know, we're certainly in a criminal justice moment, and I think it is probably one of the, you know, top two or three issues that have brought our students to law school. From my experience, it's something that, you know, is really the center of, I think, public discussion. I think, you know, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, I think, opened up a very robust public discussion on issues of mass incarceration. How would you grade our criminal justice system in 2020?
So I do not grade criminal justice systems, or in my other work, the conduct of armed conflict, on a curve.
Okay.
Because if a criminal justice system fails anyone, that is unacceptable. Whether it is police officers using lethal force without legal justification, or system of punishment that over-incarcerates, imposes disproportionate punishments, a substantive criminal law that criminalizes activity that is not particularly wrongful or harmful to society. Those are all fundamental failures, which I think should be recognized as such. And I feel the same way about the conduct of armed conflict by militaries. Of course, when a given state, government, military takes a position on the law of armed conflict that I think is sound, I will applaud them for doing so. But if they take other positions that I would argue remove legal protections from civilians, then I'm going to condemn and criticize that and explain in my work why their legal position is wrong and why they are depriving civilians of legal protections to which they are entitled. I work on very high stakes issues. And in those contexts, as I said, I don't grade on a curve. C is not good enough. And so I would say that our criminal justice system deserves an F, and we need to really pull out all the stops to stop it from failing more and more people.
And I think you know that all first-year students at Rutgers in the incoming class were asked to read Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, which is just a powerful book and really an indictment on our criminal justice system on so many different levels, on our humanity, I would say. It's, I think, one of those works that I think has really had a transformational change, because I think what it does is it really humanized the various actors, including people serving lifetime sentences. It humanized them in a way that I think, you know, that systems almost as a general matter do not.
So I agree. And I guess I'd just add, we're in a moment where there is tremendous energy and desire for systemic change in criminal law and elsewhere in our society. And, you know, I fully, fully support that. But I do always try to remind students that law is one of the few professions, maybe medicine is the other that comes to mind, where you can save a life or transform a life. And that is a good life's work. And I think that stories like the one told in Just Mercy, I hope it also reminds folks of that. I never want young people starting their legal career to feel that their work is just a drop in the bucket and therefore is somehow not worth pursuing. On the contrary, I think that if you can save one person from injustice, from losing years of their life or their entire life, that is a life's work. That is something to take immense pride in. That's something to get up every day and devote yourself to. And I'm very happy that that very powerful story is out there, both to remind us of the need for systemic change, but also to remind us of the value of the day-to-day work of social justice, criminal justice, and the practice of law.
Let me ask you this. So, you know, just to close, tell us what you're working on now.
So before COVID hit, I was actually planning to pivot some of my work, which is generally engaged with the pressing issues of the day, with issues of war and peace, issues of life and death, and just take a year or so to think about some foundational issues about the sources of international law, how we interpret treaties, how we identify rules of customary international law, and to really fully inhabit and indulge my philosophical leanings. And then COVID hit, and now all of that seems very abstract and detached. And so I'm trying to find ways to bring myself back and work productively on issues of social justice and public health. And I'm fortunate that I do have one outlet for that, which is that I'm on the board of editors of a national security blog called Just Security. And through my editorial work, I'm able to facilitate other authors who work on issues of public health, on issues of racial justice, and to help give them a platform to reach, if not a broader audience, certainly a different audience for their work, and hopefully in that way contribute behind the scenes to some progress.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Adil Haque, Professor of Law, Judge John O. Newman Scholar. Thank you for being on our faculty, and thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, this was fun.
The Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With two locations minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal, small campus experience. Learn more about Rutgers Law by visiting law.rutgers.edu.